The Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, has said that Russia will carry out the operation until the end. What has prompted Russia to have such an aggressive stance towards Ukraine, which it says it is demilitarizing and denazifying and getting rid of dangerous nationals? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at other cases of wars and territorial gains, which the West has chosen not to highlight, displaying its double standards, like the war in Yemen, or Israel's land grab from Palestinians, or Syria's Golan Heights. Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have former U.S. diplomat and foreign policy analyst James Jatras, who joins us from Virginia. Also joining us, radio host and political analyst Tim Kirby, who joins us from Moscow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Jim Jatras, first of all, welcome to you both. Jim Jatras, I'll start with you. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has told his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, the goal of this operation that it's executing against Ukraine, demilitarization and to achieve neutral status. He said it will be achieved. Demilitarization is understood. What do you think he means by neutral status?
Be non-aligned status, I think. And that means that whatever is left of Ukraine after the detachment of the Donbass and perhaps other areas of the east and south into what will likely become a new state, is that what is left of a Ukrainian state will have to be non-aligned, in the sense that Finland, Sweden, and Austria were during the first Cold War. I don't think we can ignore the fact that there will now be, maybe for a generation, a new Cold War in Europe, and that Ukraine can be a neutral state under those circumstances, if it wants to exist at all. And that was essentially what Moscow was asking for the whole of Ukraine up till now. Security guarantees, the end of NATO expansion, neutrality, which now even Mr. Zelensky is willing to offer when it's rather too late for the state that he led.
Trying to understand what's going on, Tim Kirby, when it comes to the narratives here. Let's get to that in a minute. When we talk about demilitarization, Tim Kirby, maybe you could enlighten us as to what Russia is saying, because it's saying, listen, Ukraine is posing a threat to us. It's on our borders. But then you have the West, the U.S. and Germany, who has pumped in all these supplies to Ukraine. They keep giving supplies, military equipment to Ukraine. What is the goal there by doing that? I mean, do they want this war to continue? Isn't that one of the messages that it is sending?
Okay, your question has a few different levels here. Does the West want this war to keep going? Well, the West seems to have been very hostile towards Russia since the beginning of time, it would seem. So, the more weapons that they can somehow send over to keep Russia's economy perhaps under pressure and keep Russian soldiers dying, they're thrilled with the option that works in their interests. Why the Russians want demilitarization is because they have a regime next to them that has carried out a lot of murders of Russian-speaking people, banned their language with no shame for 8 years, and that group of people, Zelensky said openly that he was considering pursuing nuclear weapons, and just today the Russians say that their intelligence has the proof that they were actually going to put together a nuclear arsenal and perhaps use it. So, you could see how Russia might want to keep whatever shape this future Ukrainian state looks like, to keep it relatively helpless, a helpless, neutral, open borderlands.
Yeah, this narrative that I spoke about minutes ago, which I didn't continue with that line, I want to ask you and start with you here, James Dutras, because we're getting, in essence, really somewhat two different narratives. When you have the Russian presidents and Russian officials, including the foreign minister, talk about how they want to denazify Ukraine, the role of Nazism and nationals that Russia continues to repeat. And even just the video that we played that was just in, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, said neo-Nazi units are using foreign mercenaries from the Middle East and are using civilians as human shields. We don't hear this in the Western media. We hear this coming from Russia. Tell us your take on what is going on here.
Well, you know, one of the problems with modern-day Ukraine as it emerged in 1991 is that it did not agree on its historical narrative, even to the point of whose side were you on during World War II? And you have people in the West who sympathize with Mr. Bandera and the SS Galicia unit and all that. They were the good guys as far as they were concerned. And most people in East Ukraine did not have that feeling at all, that they supported the Soviet Union in the war against Nazi Germany. You know, there's an element of hyperbole in talking about Nazis in Ukraine, but underlying it is a very real thing, which is there are very radical groups that have extreme nationalist views that essentially hold this government in Kiev hostage. Remember, Mr. Zelensky won in 2019 on a peace platform with the entire country voting for him. 70% of the vote landslide, except for the very far west, which is where these groups are concentrated. However, when you talk about Pravi Sektor, the Azov Battalion, these are groups that essentially make it impossible for any government in Kiev to pursue a more moderate course, make it impossible for them to negotiate with the Donbass republics as required under the Minsk II agreement. So in a way, this thing was baked into the cake, that there was a state that was paralyzed by these radical groups. And also you had the complete flat refusal of Washington and NATO to discuss Russia's security concerns, particularly the first or further expansion of NATO. You know, if the West had pursued a different course and said, sure, we'll talk about that. NATO doesn't need to expand anymore. Yes, Kiev must talk to the Donbass republics. Let's make that happen. This would not have happened. Now, I think Moscow knew that there would not be any positive response in that respect. And frankly, I think there are people in the West who really wanted this outcome so they could demonize Russia, force Russia out of European affairs, keep the Germans and the French under Washington's thumb, and sell a lot of weapons in the meantime. What's not to love?
Okay. Now, that is perhaps something that needs either your agreement or disagreement on, Tim Kirby. What do you think about the last statement made there? Maybe that is an outcome that Washington perhaps wanted in terms of what we're seeing unfold.
Well, if you're talking about making money off of war, I think the prime example of this would be that a member of the Atlantic Council, his name slips my memory for the moment, but he wrote a piece for Foreign Policy that basically said that the United States needs to prepare for war, not just against Russia, but also against China right now. And what's the solution? What is that form of preparation for this super war? Doubling the U.S. military budget. So that would be from about $750 billion as it is now a year to $1.5 trillion. Let the corruption train roll, you know. So, yeah, there's definitely a monetary element to all of this. Of course, it's maybe not the real underlying total motivation, but it certainly pushes towards the necessity for war. That's for sure.
Well, James Dutras, we can't help but talk a little bit about the economic strain that this is putting on the world and the respective countries, including Russia. Russia, however, my question is, seems to have calculated its pre-launch stature in terms of trying to somewhat cushion or prepare for this. What is your view about the extreme sanctions that are placed on Russia and, of course, what the world is experiencing? Europe and the U.S. are not exempt, obviously, on a whole variety of sectors that you're seeing price surges. I mean, is that coming at the expense of people, to say the least?
Of course it is. And this is where we are getting into the fact that there is a full-scale confrontation between the West and Russia now. There are actually several wars going on right now. One is the military action on the ground. There's a reason why the Western media are misrepresenting the military war and saying, oh, the Russians are behind schedule. They're meeting stiff resistance. They're attacking the civilian population. You notice you don't even see any reports of the electricity going out in Ukraine. Unlike when we attack a country, whether it's Serbia or Iraq or Libya, and the first thing we do is knock out all of the infrastructure, the electrical system and the water and the communications and everything else, the bridges and the roads and the rail. They're not doing that. They're not trying to destroy Ukraine. They're trying to encircle. They're trying to kill too many Ukrainian soldiers. They're trying to encircle them and give them the option of surrendering because they want to be able to, as they said, denazify Ukraine, install a more friendly government, allow maybe some of the eastern and southern regions to form a new state if they wish to do that, but not to actually destroy the place like we have a habit of destroying countries. We're also seeing the economic war, which is going to have very significant blowback in Western countries, less so in the United States, more so in Europe, where they're not going to have access to Russian energy, raw materials, metals, agriculture. And this is going to be a real problem. But most of all, what the West is fighting, an information war to make the Russians out. You know, what we saw with the demonization of Milosevic or Assad or Gaddafi or whoever it is, we're going to see that to the nth degree in this. And that's really the war that's being fought. And that's why I fear a huge false flag atrocity of some sort is in preparation now.
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about the double standards, Tim Kirby, we can talk about, of course, how Joe Biden, when he was a senator, how he promoted, war on Iraq, of which he's now saying, you know, this is not something that needs to happen. However, we're seeing what he's promoting when it comes to Ukraine. Another double standards that are at play here, where perhaps maybe you can tell us, of course, the U.S.-led NATO war in Libya is one prime example, the war in Yemen. I mean, enlighten us as to how these double standards are unfolding and why the media is reaching out to the viewers on an emotional level when these other scenarios can also be reached out to viewers on an emotional level also.
Well, the source of where these double standards come from is generally people who believe in a certain double standard, not just in international relations, but even in their personal lives. It's generally because they have a complete and total lack of respect for the other party. They can't perceive what this other party thinks or does, so they feel that this double standard is completely fine because they have no concern for what the other is thinking. And that's exactly what is happening here. The United States generally, because it could not care less about what others or outsiders think or do, it sees all of its actions as part of some sort of overall noble pursuit or some sort of global police work, whereas any military actions pursued against their interests are part of some sort of magical axis of evil. It's sort of the dark side of human nature, especially human nature that is a very, very low view of other people, especially Russians.
James Jatross, looking at the bigger picture here, there's been in the past decade or even longer this world order that we hear about, the new world order. I'm guessing that this may be, again, a new world order when you take a look at, for lack of a better word, the decoupling that's taking place, Russia from the West, at least at this stage. What are we looking at in terms of that? Is this something that's really going to change the way that Russia is going to interact in the world or decouple from the West, U.S. and Europe? And what is that going to entail? What is it going to look like?
Absolutely. It's a new, if you will, a new world order that we're looking at now. And it can go one of two ways. And I think this is why Mr. Lavrov said today that Russia will see this through militarily to the end, that I don't think that it will get sidetracked on trying to restrain themselves in the hopes that the other side will behave reasonably. I think they decided to cross that Rubicon when they got no action at all, no response at all to their ultimatum of December 17th. I think what's one of two things are going to happen. Either the Russians will press this on to the point of victory, and at that point, the world will be confronted with a fait accompli. This is what Russia has now done in its vital national interest. It has reordered a country that actually was, in a way, far less destructive than we have destroyed other countries for no national gain, or it's possible they fail. And then if they do that, and Russia then is subordinated to the globalist system coming from the West, yes, the unipolar world will continue then at that point, and of course its next target will be China. And so it could go that way. I don't think it will. I think it's more likely that the Russians will prevail, that Washington will be presented with this new reality, and that we will have willy-nilly the emergence of a multipolar world.
Sure. Well, one country that I'm sure is looking, Tim Kirby, at all of this is China. And I'm sure Russia, I mean, prior to this military operation, Russia and China came out, if you recall, during the Winter Olympics, they came out and made a strong statement standing up to NATO, and of course the U.S. by default, in a sense. Are we looking at that bond, if it was any closer, to even become ever closer in terms of both economic and military spheres, and Russia moving further east?
Well, on the economic level, I mean, Russia's just been more or less blocked from every major Western corporation that we can think of. Some of these may be actually good in the long run, like getting rid of McDonald's, but others could be very difficult, like losing the ability to get processors from Taiwan. So in a lot of ways, China is going to kind of pick up the slack from Europe's products for Russia to go forward into the future. And this symbiosis between Russia and China, if it works out, it'll be good. But if China blinks or changes their mind or gets skittish, Russia could be in a lot of trouble because although the Russian economy is pretty good and Russia produces a lot of the things that are at the store, it doesn't produce 100% of it, and they could be in trouble. I think the real war now within Russia that has to be won, defeating the Ukrainian military is a joke. Russia's using less than 5% of its total might to deal with this problem, and it's winning heavy completely. The military side is easy. The tough side is the economics. That's where the real battle is going to be, and China will be a massive, massive help in this process. Again, if they don't happen to change their mind or get skittish or whatnot.
Well, do you think that China's going to blink, James Dutras?
I could be wrong, but I don't think we say that Russia has taken this all into the account before they launched the operation. Remember that statement that came from President Xi and President Putin a few weeks ago? I think the Chinese realize, too, that they have to brass this out along with the Russians, or else they're in a very bad position. You know, China's the only economy on the planet that's comparable to the American economy. Russia's is the only military power on the planet that is comparable to ours. The two of them together, having each other's back, Eurasia is a real counterbalance and rival to the power of the United States and our various satellites around the world. If one of them goes down and the other one is then faced with a confrontation with Washington all by itself, that's not good. And I think the Chinese know that, and they don't want to be caught in that position.
Well, trying to figure out here some of the stances that NATO is going to take and the European sides, which we're seeing at this point, based on how it's being reported, Tim Kirby, that NATO is more unified than ever. European countries are now, like Germany, who are going to spend so much more money on their defense. Even as you said, if Russia completes its military operation and reaches its objectives, won't the tensions still exist? In other words, doesn't there need to be some kind of settlement on this issue or issues in order for there to be, you know, peace? In order for there to be coexistence, in other words?
Well, there's always going to be tension between Russia and continental Europe, and especially the Anglo-Saxons beyond. That is always the way it's going to be. It has been that way for centuries. It was even that way when Peter the Great had to deal with the Swedes. This is not anything new. This is the way the world works. I should remind people that this whole concept of a multipolar world is not a world of pacifism. It's a world that has a lot of peace in it. Hopefully, it'll be very pleasant to live in, but it's not centered around the idea that it'll be the end of all wars and all conflicts. Stress is always going to be there. Russia has been, probably since the Catholic and Eastern Orthodox churches split, Russia was never going to be welcome back in Europe, and it still hasn't to this day. As in Putin, when he was explaining the whole logic of this intervention to the Russian public, he even mentioned that in the 90s, for the first time he mentioned this openly and confirmed something that was a rumor, you know, Russia told NATO, okay, we're ready. We're ready to join. We're kind of ready to be part of the West. You got us. You defeated us. We're your vassals now. We'll go serve you. And NATO said, no, just because they're Russian, they're different, they're not Europeans. That hatred, that geopolitical aspect, the cultural divide is not going to go anywhere. It's been there for hundreds of years. It's going to still be there tomorrow.
James Vitrous, my final question to you at this point is regarding this military operation that Russia is executing. It has said that we're not interested in putting and installing a government there. So what are Russia's plans when it comes to that? I mean, would it be directly involved once and if, we're assuming that it will, at least Tim Kirby has indicated as such, that it's going to, you know, be successful. What future plans does Russia have for that, if any, for the future government there in Kiev, if that was to be the case?
Well, if their goal is not regime change, I wonder why they bother. Yes, of course it has to be regime change. And I hope these talks that are going on in Belarus are simply a smokescreen, and they're simply going to continue their operation until the people sitting across the table from them become clear they're not representing any government that in fact exists. And then some new order will take place there. Now, you know, maybe Mr. Zelensky or other people currently in the Ukrainian government could be part of that once they realize that they have no other options. And maybe when they feel freed from the pressure of these more radical national elements that have been disposed of. But I think if Russia were to somehow stop before completely remaking the Ukrainian state, it would be a horrible mistake on their part, and they would be simply saving themselves up for an even worse conflict in the future, which is actually what I think they're seeking to avoid.
And Tim Kirby, final question to you. You're saying Russia is using 5% of its capabilities. The Russian foreign minister has said that it seems like NATO is interested in having a third world war, and also that would entail nuclear use of nuclear weapons. How much of a possibility do you think that is to come?
Well, just to explain
reality?
One thing. Again, this what he said is coming from a Russian standpoint, where from the West, what Russia's doing seems like some sort of surprise or aggression or randomness. But really, NATO has kept the pressure on Russia, whether Russia was the Soviet Union, the big enemy, whether it was during the Yeltsin period, where it was a complete submissive vassal, during the early Putin period as a sort of semi-friend, and now whatever the relationship is now. The thing is, it consistently always keeps the pressure on Russia. So I think, in a sense, what they're trying to say is that overall attitude and that continuous pressure, it really opens the door to a World War III sort of scenario. If NATO were to have backed off, or especially if NATO would have absorbed Russia in the 1990s, well, then that situation would be impossible today, wouldn't it?
Well, end it there. Thank you very much for that. Tim Kirby from Moscow, radio host and political analyst. James Vitrous, thank you for your contribution from Virginia, former U.S. diplomat and foreign policy analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavoy, entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful. who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the absolutely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَيَوْمَ يَعَضُّ الظَّالِمُ عَلَى يَدَيْهِ يَقُولُ يَا لَيْتَنِي اتَّخَذْتُ مَعَ الرَّسُولِ سَبِيلًا
And the day when the wrongdoer will bite at his hands, he will say, Oh, would that I had taken a path with the messenger.
يَا وَيْلَتَى لَيْتَنِي لَمْ أَتَّخِذْ فُلَانًا خَلِيلًا
Ah, woe to me, would that I had never taken so-and-so as a friend.
لَقَدْ أَضَلَّنِي عَنِ الذِّكْرِ بَعْدَ إِذْ جَاءَنِي وَكَانَ الشَّيْطَانُ لِلْإِنسَانِ خَذُولًا
He indeed led me astray from the reminder after it had come to me, and Satan is ever a deserter to man in the hour of need.
وَقَالَ الرَّسُولُ يَا رَبِّ إِنَّ قَوْمِ اتَّخَذُوا هَذَا الْقُرْآنَ مَهْجُورًا
And the messenger will say, O my Lord, verily my people deserted this Qur'an.
Brothers and sisters, we are now going to discuss the 30th verse of this chapter Furqan. وَقَالَ الرَّسُولُ يَا رَبِّ إِنَّ قَوْمِ اتَّخَذُوا هَذَا الْقُرْآنَ مَحْجُورًا And the messenger will say on that day, O my Lord, verily my people treated this Qur'an with neglect. The Prophet says, O Allah, people have deserted the Holy Qur'an. Since you may have followed some of our previous episodes, you already know that the previous verses mentioned the different kinds of pretext-seeking of some stubborn polytheists and some of those unbelievers. And this holy verse mentions a complaint, an annoyance of the Prophet ﷺ about this incorrect behavior of the group with the Holy Qur'an. So it says, وَقَالَ الرَّسُولُ Since the previous verses were continuing the discussion about that day, about hereafter, and the day of regret, the day of resurrection, this verse is continuing what is happening on that day. وَقَالَ الرَّسُولُ And the messenger will say on that day, يَا رَبِّ O my Lord, إِنَّ قَوْمِ اتَّخَذُوا هَذَا الْقُرْآنَ مَهْجُورًا Verily my people have treated this Qur'an with neglect. This complaint of the Holy Prophet ﷺ is still heard. He complains to Allah even about a large group of Muslims who have neglected the Holy Qur'an, which is the secret of life. This Holy Qur'an is the means of salvation. This is the factor of victory. This is the criterion of development of and movement. This is the practical life program. But some Muslims have neglected this book and have begged others for their civil and criminal laws.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran
by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, by studying the situation of the people of Islamic countries, especially those who are culturally under the control of Western and Eastern countries, you realize that Holy Quran is changed into a kind of ceremonial book. They haven't recognized the Holy Quran as the life program. This book is neglected among them. Only its words are nicely broadcasted by a few speakers, and its words are seen on glazed tiles of mosques. But the words of Quran are seen as architecture. It is used for making new house blissful. It is used for protecting a traveler and for healing patients. Or most of the time its words and its verses are recited for its reward. What I'm saying is that these things are not unlawful. They're not against the Holy Quran. But the point is, when the Prophet of Islam on that day says that my Lord have treated this Quran with neglect, my people have deserted the Holy Quran, he means that people have deserted the teachings, the verses, and the content of this book. Sometimes we hear that some negligent people argue by using the Holy Quran that their aim is to prove their prejudgments by the help of its verses, and their interpretation is according to their personal opinions, acting based on the verses and teachings of this Holy Quran first needs its recitation. We need to see its words and then go through the meaning, through the words, through the apparent sentences. That is why in some Islamic countries, there are great schools that are named schools of memorization of the Holy Quran. In these schools, girls and boys are memorizing the Holy Quran, while their thoughts are sometimes influenced by the Western and Eastern countries. Reciting the Holy Quran, memorizing its words, sentences, verses, and chapters are not going to help us if our culture is borrowed from some non-Islamic countries. If the verses of the Holy Quran, the teachings of Quran, are only applied for covering our wrong actions, then we must be aware that we might be the subject to this verse, where the Holy Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, will say and announce on that day, "Inna qawmi ittakhadhu hadha al-Quran mahjura." And the Prophet is also crying it today, only if we had ears. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode of the program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A huge number of Ukrainian refugees continue to arrive at EU borders in Poland, Slovakia, Romania and Hungary. On Thursday, EU Home Affairs ministers adopted the Temporary Protection Directive. It means the refugees can work and go to school in any of the bloc's 27 member states for at least 1 year.
If you compare to the refugees that came in 2015, how long time it took to have the proper decisions. For example, just to have their asylum applications processed, it could take years.
So, by the EU's own admission, refugees travelling here from conflict zones involving Western military powers did not and do not receive the same protection. Meanwhile, advocates are calling on the EU to pay particular attention to certain groups.
In general, people who are displaced in a forced way are vulnerable. But we want to call attention to specifically the situation of women and girls because they are disproportionately affected.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen travelled to Slovakia and Romania on Thursday to assess the refugee crises facing the two EU nations. She took the opportunity to try and apply additional pressure on Moscow.
The three waves of sanctions we introduced are already having an impact on the Russian economy and therefore Putin's war effort. And we will take additional steps if the situation deteriorates on the ground.
Non-EU country Moldova has taken in more than 100,000 Ukrainian refugees so far. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell visited the country on Thursday to offer support. However, there is concern over the treatment of some who are trying to reach the EU from Ukraine. Senior UN officials are criticising evidence of discrimination by EU border authorities against African and Asian nationals attempting to flee the conflict. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Press TV, Brussels.
Al-Fajr cultural days have kicked off, but this time it is not held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Rather, Beirut is hosting the event like many other Iranian art exhibitions held here.
Activities include many art activities, theater, music, exhibition, seminars and other activities.
The Iranian Minister of Culture opened the festivals with an awe-inspiring musical concert. Iranian musicians there glad to be attending such an event.
I'm a musician from Iran. I play oud, a common instrument in Muslim world. I really like the Arabic culture, Arabic countries' cultures. By myself, and I think the collaboration between Muslim countries, it would be good. Something like Fajr days in Lebanon, and I really enjoy my stay in Lebanon.
The many facets of Iran's artistic culture have come all the way to Lebanon, from the folklore dress to post-Islamic calligraphy.
This exhibition is for Iranian exhibition for the Iranian handicraft for before Islam and after Islam.
According to organizers, this event is significant in that it represents part of collaboration between Iran and Lebanon. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The World Bank has recently approved a plan to use more than $1 billion from a frozen Afghan trust fund for aid in Afghanistan through UN agencies and charities. Afghan experts welcoming the move suggest that there should be a clear mechanism for disbursing the money so that Afghanistan gains the greatest benefits.
Allocating $1 billion as aid is a piece of good news for Afghanistan, but there should be a clear and appropriate mechanism so that the money is not wasted like hundreds of billions of dollars that were poured into Afghanistan in the past 20 years. I think, first of all, the UN should come to an understanding with the Taliban. Then they can assess needs or create jobs through developmental and fundamental projects.
This comes as unemployment, poverty and hunger crises are deepening in Afghan society. Afghans expect the Taliban and international community to create job opportunities, calling for unfreeze of Afghanistan's frozen funds and more aid to the country.
We have been experiencing a very harsh winter. Many died of hunger and illnesses. We neither have a job nor received humanitarian aid.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets and large global funds to the country were halted. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turkey has closed the passage of warships through its straits of Bosphorus and Dardanelles. The decision was taken after Ankara called Russia's military action in Ukraine a war. President Erdogan said Turkey is using the authority given to it by the 1963 Montreux Convention Pact on passage of its straits to prevent the escalation of the Russia and Ukraine conflict.
Turkey is determined to use the authority given by the Montreux Convention on Turkish Straits in a manner to prevent escalation of the Russia-Ukraine crisis.
Erdogan said he was very saddened by Moscow's attack on its neighbor, describing the move as unacceptable, adding that Turkey will not abandon its ties with both Ukraine and Russia. The Turkish defense minister, in his turn, asked all sides to respect the international pact Turkey has worked by, assuring that it is Ankara's right to limit passage in the straits in wartime. Kiev had already asked Turkey to close its straits to the Russian warships. The move will prevent more Russian ships from reaching the Black Sea, from where it had launched attacks on Ukrainian southern coast. Analysts say Turkey's decision does not only help Ukraine but also Russia, as the decision prevents all warships, not only Russian ones, from crossing the straits.
Turkey is following a balanced policy between the two countries. The president already clearly stated that Ankara will not take side and stand with neither Russia nor Ukraine. However, enforcing the Montreux Convention is an international procedure, which will not affect Russia negatively, and Ukraine had already asked for it, hence Turkey will not be put in a position to choose sides. However, Turkey already rejects the Russian military action.
Turkey maintains good ties with both Russia and Ukraine, as it bought S-400 missiles from the first and sold the drones to the second, and does not seem willing to risk taking sides in this conflict. It seems that Turkey is trying to remain impartial in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, while it's trying to mediate to end the fight, with President Erdogan making some calls and pushing for a political solution. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Home Office has verified that the majority of people trying to reach the UK's shores via the English Channel are fleeing war and persecution. This comes in response to allegations made by the Home Secretary that the majority are illegitimate, in her own words, asylum shoppers.
If the laws that they're trying to put through Parliament at the present time, if they had been in process at the time that the present Home Secretary, Priti Patel, the time her family came as refugees and asylum seekers from Uganda, they would not have been allowed to come into the United Kingdom. Or if they did come into the United Kingdom, they would be put into some sort of detention camps that she is advocating.
The issue of Ukrainian refugees also got off to a rocky start, with the Home Secretary suggesting they could benefit from fruit picker visas. Now, under pressure, the government is offering emergency visas for those with family members already living in Britain. But at the same time, the government is pushing through legislation that will criminalise those coming from the Middle East and Africa, specifically via the English Channel, and people protesting this are getting mixed responses.
It's interesting that while we've been reporting here today, we have heard people pass by making some pretty off-colour remarks about refugees arriving here in this country. And that just confirms that there is a lack of sympathy here. And some would say those sentiments stem from misinformation, but most importantly, from racism.
White skin, blue eyes. They've said it on the media. White skin, blue eyes means you're acceptable. If you're brown-skinned or black-skinned, you're not acceptable. And it's a form of apartheid.
There are people who have been driven to suicide after arriving in Britain. There were actually more people dying after being in the hands of the Home Office here than the numbers that had been dying crossing the Channel. And that is crazy to think that the hope and the aspiration that drives a person to risk their life, the kind of Britain that they're hoping for, is the one we want to live in. But it's not the one we have. It's what we have is deeply driven, divided by racism.
The Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK extraordinary powers to criminalise, prosecute and imprison refugees, and give the Coast Guard immunity from prosecution if refugees die at sea. there have been widespread protests demanding this bill be scrapped, specifically now that the government is poised to issue hundreds of thousands of visas for Ukrainians, proving that when there's a will, there's a way. Bianca Rahimi, London.
British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's licence to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik, as well as their subsidiaries, will no longer be able to spread their lies to justify Putin's war and to sow division in our union.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship, and the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy, and that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time, but observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
Palestinians in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets in support of more than 4,500 prisoners who are facing strict punitive measures and collective punishment by Israeli prison authorities. Recently, the prisoners have taken a series of actions against new restrictions imposed on them by Israeli authorities. Prisoners' advocacy groups who organized the protest described the prisoners' actions as an uprising or intifada.
I prefer to call it the prisoners' intifada or uprising because the inmates face daily assault caused by the prison administration, who is seeking to destroy their collective efforts over the years that aim to improve living conditions in detention.
Tensions in Israeli prisons have escalated since September 2021, following the escape of six prisoners from the Gilboa High Security Jail. Although they were caught after a massive manhunt, Israeli officials implemented several punitive measures against the remaining detainees, such as banning visits and reducing their yard time, which led to clashes and strikes.
The prisoners are our red line. We will not allow prison authorities to cross it, and we will not remain silent on these punitive measures against our freedom fighters. And we know at the end of the day they will achieve victory as they did in previous battles. The prison administration knows very well what it's doing will only lead to more tension.
As part of those actions taken by the prisoners since January the 1st, some 500 detainees have been boycotting the Israeli military court system to protest their imprisonment under the so-called administrative detention. Today, some 4,500 Palestinians are held in Israeli prisons, including 180 children and 34 women. Palestinians hail them as freedom fighters.
Prisoners' advocacy groups say 2022 has been worse for the Palestinian prisoners so far, and the inmates themselves believe that they are in need of such solidarity protests because the worst is yet to come in the wake of the escalating tough measures by the Israeli prison authorities. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Following the recent retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army and its aerial strikes on Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, the United Nations Security Council imposed an arms embargo on Yemen's Ansarullah movement. This measure was proposed by the UAE in an attempt to curtail the military capabilities of the Yemeni army.
Arms embargo on Yemen is not new. As everyone knows, we are prohibited from even buying fuel, foodstuffs. Today, Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel crisis due to the seizure of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The Yemeni army depends on the Yemeni military industries, which have proven to the world the growing military capabilities of Yemen. This resolution will not stop the Yemeni missile attacks, but rather will prompt the Yemeni army to intensify its retaliatory operations.
In a Twitter post, the member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, criticized the measure, saying it has ignored war crimes by the Saudi-led coalition. He noted that any arms embargo that does not apply to the Western-backed coalition has no value.
The Security Council's resolution will not affect Yemen in facing the Saudi-led war. The Yemeni army continues to make progress on all battlefronts, and this measure is only aimed at satisfying Saudi Arabia and its allies. The resolution also aims to prolong the war on Yemen and halt any move toward peace. We, as the Yemeni people, are besieged. Our airports and ports are closed, and we cannot buy weapons like other countries. So this decision will not have any effect.
Saudi Arabia's allies have launched a deadly war on Yemen since the beginning of 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, many of them women and children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to escalate its retaliatory attacks against Saudi and Emirati territories.
Experts say the Yemeni army depends on local military industries in addition to the spoils of war left by the Saudi-led coalition's forces after escaping the battlefronts. They believe that the UN resolution will make no difference as Yemen is besieged by Saudi Arabia since the beginning of the war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Images may soon be a thing of the past if Brussels has its way and removes Russian-backed media RT and Sputnik and their subsidiaries from the airwaves. British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's license to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship. And the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy. And that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that, really. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this massive disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
The Prophet of Mercy, a sequel to the 2015 letters written by leader of Iran's Islamic